speaking of strong, how's the Larianator tonight?
Oh, I'm strong, man. I'm strong. Coming off a big week over here. We're good.
Okay. And Gimpy, are you treading water?
Yeah, doing better.
Wow, that's a $6 million man. They got you pinned together. Captain Kirk's a long time no talk.
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Yeah, I heard that we lost our third segment of observations this afternoon.
Oh,
and you were on a roll, so there we go. So we're going to reprise some of that.
And that's exactly when I called in, too. It was bad.
Oh,
you guys heard me, right?
Oh, absolutely. You were spectacular.
Fabulous.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure everybody got it.
Yeah. Yeah. So this particular proverb is something we went over quickly in shows a long time ago, and we've been retracing our steps because upon further investigation, the fatherly advice was more direct to our particular mission than we had ever thought before. And when I say our particular mission, I sense to a large degree that that our Teruah chorus for these days is specifically designed to do what this proverb is doing, to highlight the reasons that God is opposed to religion and politics, to explain what the resolution is if you have been involved in religion and politics, and specifically to call out and criticize the most popular religions and political schemes. Now, some of these things you wouldn't think would need a whole lot of exposure. I mean, I watched enough of the presidential debate last night to know that there isn't a viable candidate in the lot of them.
Did you take a bath afterwards?
You know, you feel like you need to. It's the same thing as studying Paul's letters and writing Questioning Paul, or studying Muhammad's insane diatribe to write prophecy.
I'll take my hat off to you for both of those.
You know, I'm currently beginning the fourth chapter of Observations for a Time, and I decided that I wanted to do something that I haven't done, and I don't know how long we've been doing this, but I think it's 15 years that this all began. And and for 15 years ago, I heard this voice inside that said, you know, I'd like you to go on a mission for me. There's something I'd like you to do for me. You know, who is this? It happens to be God. Yeah, right. And what I want you to do is I want you to expose and condemn Islam. I want people left without an excuse. And, you know, I recall the whole discussion about, I'm not qualified for that. And you know, by the time we finished negotiating, and God gave me exactly what he wanted to do. In other words, once I asked him for what he wanted, we were off to the races. But the confirmation that he was going to do what he had promised, you know, he said, you know, it's in your right pants pocket. Read it. And there, sitting in my right pants pocket, was the 91st Psalm. And when I recall having read it 15 years ago, the day happened to be Teruah, of all things. It was Teruah in September of 2001. And for the first time now in 15 years, I've actually written down what occurred on that day. Now, for the first time, actually starting to translate the 91st Psalm. You know, I kind of began the chapter by saying this is the Psalm that launched 3 million words. I think that's where we are thus far. Is 3 million words.
That's astounding, Yana.
Yeah, you know,
really.
And guys, it all began. Because, and Roy is much more adept at this than I am, but while Yahweh cannot and does not want to see his future in the seventh dimension. He absolutely can see our future as in this world of 3.5 dimensions that he created for us. And so he can tell, he knew how Larry, how JB, how Kirk and I were going to respond to his invitation. And so he knew that we'd be open-minded, that we would go where the words lead, we were willing to invest the time, that we would enjoy the process of getting to know him. And so he did for us a great favor in introducing himself. And,
well, he did. You know, when he talks, and one of the things I do understand is free will. I mean that's paramount in any real relationship.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And he talks about knowing Irma Yahu in the womb.
Yeah. Right.
And that means that although Irma Yahu had not maybe known him yet, he knew him before, you know, vice versa. And that means that it's the same thing with us, is that Yahweh, you know, and I've had many people ask this, you know, how is it I felt protected before I knew Yahweh? It's just simple. You know Yahweh, and he's not going to let his children not be protected, I mean, in situations where they need to be. And, you know, there are situations where we don't need to be. There are situations where, like Yasha Yah decide, you know, it's time to be murdered, or Zachariah, same thing.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that was the thing that was so strong with me, because at the time, I read it, and it said, you know, one of the things I wanted was, since exposing Muslims had caused most people to go into hiding, and many were hunted down and killed, I wanted my family and home protected. This wasn't their fight. And so the psalm begins with a promise to do that, and it continues in that regard. And I don't think Yahweh intervenes very often in free will. I think it's few and far between when he does it. He certainly doesn't do it to help people score touchdowns or get base hits, or to get a yes on a date with a pretty girl. But when it's his family, and his family is engaged in something he wants done, he absolutely does. And so I'm quite convinced that over the course of the last 15 years, that there have been Malak whose job it was to deter Muslims from killing me. And it's not because I'm special, at least among people, but, you know, if you're willing to do what God wants done, he's going to make certain that you have that opportunity.
Yeah, and he knows you before you knew him. That's the whole point.
Correct. Yeah, it is.
That means that protection is there, whether you know it or not.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, there were three times in my life prior to that request where I should have been dead. You know, I nearly died of malaria, and it's a miracle I survived malaria. But it's malaria that saved my life, because it kept me off an airplane that was the first act of international Islamic terrorism, where the 77 people aboard all died. I was taken on that airplane.
Wow.
And, you know, there are a number of situations. You know, I was flying my airplane. Pretty remarkable bird back in the day that I had a Pilatus, but you couldn't stall it. If you stalled it, you were going to die. It goes knife edge, and you couldn't do a roll in it because you couldn't recover from a roll. So it was designed to be stable, but I got caught in what's called wake turbulence, vortex off two Airbuses over the Pentagon going into Reagan.
And threw you away.
I was
threw you around.
I was right upside down. I was upside down over the Pentagon at about 1,000 feet. It's irrecoverable on the airplane. But you know, here we're talking. Mm-hmm. So there is, I think, a considerable amount of truth to when God says, "I knew Irma Yah in the womb." He knew each of us before we were born, and He's not intervening in free will in that regard, because he
knows, because then the relationship wouldn't be real.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
It's not like Yirmiyahu was a wind-up doll. I just want to throw this out here to you, too. You just told an incredible story there. I mean, there's no way you should have gotten out of that. I drive, typically, I've got kind of a heavy foot, 85 or 90, okay, on the freeway. I mean, that's just what I do. And I'm going down I-10, and I actually, at the time, I had a girlfriend, and my girlfriend was in the car. She saw it, I saw it. We're going down 10, headed east into Jacksonville, Florida. There is, as far as my rearview mirrors can see, nobody behind me, okay? I mean, we're just the lone car on the road. Suddenly, a car appears 6 feet in front of me. No time to react. So we just both kind of react by cringing up, as people do when all of a sudden you know you're about to have a major impact, because this car was going 10 miles an hour, maybe. It disappeared. And I looked at her, and I said, did you just see that? I'm not one given to nonsense, you know. And then she said, yeah. And I said, well, where did it go? I'm looking in my rearview mirror. I'm turning my head. I'm doing it. It's gone. The car is gone. That actually happened to me. Now, I've never told a lot of people this story. I've told a couple of people that story. I've never really, we didn't even speak about it ever again. But it was an insane situation. I mean, I don't know what you say to a thing like that. I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah, you know, when I began this, it reminds me of how I began this chapter. I went through that whole story, and you know, at the end of it, I said, it doesn't matter whether you believe that I heard this voice or that I was asked to engage in this mission. It's really irrelevant, and the reason it's irrelevant is the only thing that matters is what God said to all of us. I shared my personal experience because it provided the perspective on the relationship and my attitude as it relates to translation, because I thought, you know, it might be interesting for people to know, but it's irrelevant to anyone other than us, really how God intervenes personally. But if you think about how much would have been lost to the family and how many people would never have come to know Yahweh or engage in the covenant, if you'd run into that car.
Or you hadn't written the words that I share. You know,
right. Right. If I'd been killed earlier.
Said about Richard or Kirk or JB, right. Whoever. I'm just saying, these things happen, and again, they don't matter. And by the way, for people who don't know Yada, you've got to understand he's not one running around talking about miracles. This is not what we do here.
Uh-huh.
It's actually very strange hearing this.
By the way, I've never asked God for a miracle.
No, I haven't either.
There's no reason to.
No.
Maybe when I was a Christian to pay my electric bill when I had four a couple
maybe
of times.
So, but not since I've known him.
Right.
You know, I figure that that so long as we're doing what he wants done, my well-being is his responsibility. I don't need to ask him. Why would you ask him? And the last thing Yahweh wants to be is flashy. And so if he doesn't want to be flashy, he most certainly doesn't want somebody who wants to be flashy representing him.
Well, his words are clear, right? I know what you need before you ask.
Correct.
What's the point of asking?
What's the point of asking? I can't think of anything that I would ask God, including the thing that I want the most, which is a better understanding, an ability to translate his testimony more clearly and to describe it more accurately. I mean, that's the thing that I want the most. Find I get the most pleasure out of the thing I spend the most time doing. That's what I want the most. I don't even ask him for that. Because why would you ask him for the very thing that he wants done?
Good point.
He's already said he's going to give you.
Oh, of course.
He'd love to give you that.
Right. Of course. And so there's no reason to ask him. And so when I heard, Kirk, you were talking in the... Mm-hmm. And I think it was the third hour, third segment of observations today. And you were talking about how much fun you were having, learning the insights that lie underneath the words.
Mm-hmm.
Like we had come across a word that we're talking about. God was exposing Paul, and he said, you know, one of the things that's unique about this guy is going to be a pervert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's Paul in his seminal letter, a letter to the Romans. He said, I'm a sexual pervert. Most people don't know that. But he said, I'm a sexual pervert, and he blamed the Torah for making him a sexual pervert. And so God said, okay, I know he's going to write it.
So he wrote it first, 1,000 years earlier.
Right. It's like the fun that I found when there were two Pauline revelations that were beyond just, this is a prediction, and here's the... Here is God telling us what to look for, and he is the only person that matches it, which is just evidence and reason. But when he was talking about Paul being shifty and changing, shuffling his stance on things, well, the word that he said he was going to be shifty on and shifting his stance was ma'al, the Hebrew word for circumcision. And you go, okay, that was pretty clever.
That was...
Yeah, and then you read further, and he names him. He says, yeah, he's the lowly and little one. You know, when you find that stuff, it's fun.
Yeah, it is. I even tell people you don't have to read Paulos' letters. You can read what Yahweh said about him.
Right. Much rather read what he said
about how these have all been changed. Well, hey, welcome to the club of the many, partner. You know, all the words have been changed, you know. But it's a lot of Paulos' stuff. I mean, you know, when you start talking about castrating people that are Torah observant, come on.
Right, right. Or that if you're circumcised, that Christ can't save you. Or calling the old system, what he would then call the Old Testament, pornography. I mean,
yeah, pornos. Yeah.
As we were talking in the third hour about Paul on observations, you know, how could there be a single Christian after Paul wrote in the 13th chapter of Romans that all governments are appointed by God, that there is no government authority except by God, and that governments do not raise the sword for bad, but instead for good, when Rome, within two decades of that time, destroyed the Temple of Yahweh, hauled off hundreds of thousands of Jews into slavery, took the profits from the temple, and used it and the slaves to build the Roman Colosseum, the most disgusting arena for display of human decadence ever conceived. And then you have nation fighting nation. How in the world can these nations both derive their authority from God and be agents of God and be agents of good and only wield the sword in good if they're massacring each other?
Yeah, you know, and I've got a question here. That's a good point. You said hundreds of thousands. You know, I have tried to find, I mean, over and over, it was some information I was going to put in a note that I was doing. And I never could find out how many actual Yehudim were hauled out of Jerusalem or out of Yisrael in general into slavery in Rome. Do you have any rough estimate on that or anything?
Yeah, there are two occurrences, of course, 70 and 133.
And then 133, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And the problem is that the historians, I'm going to put that in air quotes, that are providing the information, because Hadrian wrote very little down, and his legions were decimated. So it was an unmitigated disaster for Rome, because in both attacks, it was the only time other than the freak occurrences up there in Germany where legions had to be disbanded. So the Romans didn't want to talk much about it, and then you have the Roman historians circa 300 CE that weren't historians; they were propagandists, and so they just wholly exaggerated everything. But collectively, between the two, the number appears to be somewhere around 500,000 Jews murdered, about a quarter of them by crucifixion, between the two. That would be the number killed. The number hauled off into slavery in the first incidents was in the tens to hundreds of thousands, and we don't know the number. But it's enough that that the slaves they hauled out are pictured on Hadrian's not wouldn't be Hadrian's arch it the because it Vespasian and his son their arch there are just a huge parade of Jews being hauled into Rome to build the Colosseum. The second diaspora is the big one. That's the one under Rabbi Akiva. And while most Jews escaped Israel in 70 CE, they were drawn back to Israel by Hadrian's promises to rebuild the temple. And when they arrived and returned, Hadrian sprung his trap. And at that point, there were no Jews left in the land.
Right.
All surviving Jews. All surviving Jews.
In a way, a million total.
So that should have
been 700,000.
Yeah, could have scared a million. Uh-huh.
But wow. Okay.
We don't have good numbers because the literate Hebrews were murdered because there was this great crusade against Hebrew and the Torah, and so if you could read or write Hebrew, you were burned alive, along with any document written in Hebrew, including, you know, the original copies of Matanyah and also the Torah.
Now, did Josephus say anything about this? Is that?
Oh yeah.
So I've got that. I can go downstairs maybe and do a little research for you, Larry. See what we can find.
Well, I'd like that, Kirk. And if you know, I mean, just please shoot it over to me in an email.
Because the problem even with Josephus is that
he was a traitor.
He was a traitor. You know, he was a Israeli general turned traitor. And while many of the things that he wrote were accurate, and it's our oldest resource into the period, at that point he was writing for Rome on behalf of Rome.
Yeah,
he sure as hell weren't writing for his people. Mm-hmm. So have to be careful in that regard. Yeah. I do want to share just since Lisa has been commenting on Psalm 91, just the first opening line of Psalm 91, because it has some insights that I think are fascinating. It begins, "He who dwells," speaking individually to us individually, if you will. "He who dwells," Yasab, "he who inhabits and lives, restored, he who approaches and remains, he who settles down and establishes his dwelling, he who camps out after being renewed. In the sheltered covering, in the protected place of the Almighty," this is Elyon. It's not very used very often. Elyon the root is likely the Allah, the to withdraw, to ascend, to meet the light, going up and visiting, to gain status and splendor. So, in the sheltered covering, so he who dwells in the sheltered covering, then we'd be he who camps out, enveloped in the set-apart spirit's garment of light, which is, as we know now, is the Torah, of the Almighty, in the shadow and resulting image of the most extensive and powerful one, he abides, spending the night. So, it says that if you've chosen to live sheltered, and there's only one sheltered covering, from Yahweh. That's the Torah of light that the set-apart spirit envelops us in. And this whole concept, of course, is synonymous with the idea of camping out with God. It's synonymous with Sukkah, a return to Eden, if you will. So he who camps out, he who dwells in the sheltered covering of the Almighty, in the shadow and resulting image of the most extensive and powerful one, is Shaddai. He abides, spending the night. And in the shadow, in the shadow is Ba Tesel, and it is it's from Teselim, which is image, resemblance. It's a shadow in the sense of it's an image created by the light, but in one less dimension. And so it says that we're going to be in the image. So those who choose to camp out with God are going to be in the image. And this Shaddai, the more I studied it, it means this image that we're going to be cast into, this resemblance, is of the most extensive and powerful one. Shaddai means to be, to expand, to be capable, to be powerful. So we're going to become like God, more extensive, more powerful, more capable, more influential, with greater abilities. And the word actually speaks of the ability to cultivate and to nurture life. And
wow.
So those who camp out with the Almighty are going to be in the image of the most extensive, powerful and capable one, abiding there on an ongoing basis. And then the question really is Luin, is it simply abiding, living, lodging, resting, dwelling, or is there also an aspect of night associated with it? And if it is, then we have to deal with the imagery here, which is for a while we're still here on this planet, we're in the darkness. Now, you mentioned it was a dirty job exposing Islam, exposing Christianity. It's a dirty job. So we're in the world of darkness, and yet God is going to empower us, enrich us, nurture us, making us ever more like Him. Still one less dimension than he is, at least one less dimension than he is, but still in his image, and going to protect us, nurture us, while we're in the darkness of this world. That's a pretty good start for a psalm.
Yeah, it's very enlightening. I mean, it's...
Company.
And of course, we understood that we would be exponentially growing from, you know, Shavuah as an example.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah. This is just painting a little broader strokes there, I think. You know.
Yeah. In fact, Lisa's writing the gematria for El Shaddai is the equation for pi, which, you know,
it's eternal.
It's actually an irrational number. I mean, a number that can't be resolved. But pi gives us the ability to calculate the volume in a sphere or the circumference of a circle. And what is interesting about that in relation to this particular promise is that, you know, God has said, if you choose to be in the inside of the protective covering, to be enveloped, to be surrounded by the protective covering of Yahweh, then you're going to be in the image of Pi, of the circle, of the sphere. So,
and that's what we get too out of the menorah with the 22 letters divided by the 7. You get pi again, you know, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you got the eternal light of Yahweh. See, I mean,
yeah,
that's pretty clear.
You know, that the math that's associated with his alphabet and the words that he chooses to use is, I am certain, is well beyond what we have considered, and is another affirmation. But, you know, fortunately, we've got an eternity to study those formulas. And all of them will be interesting.
Well, this right, week, that was the case this week. Every time I looked something, I found something new. It was freaky. I just went, wow. And this was old material I'd already done. And I went back and did it again independently.
Yeah, I'm quite convinced that there would be nothing I would ever publish if I would reach a point where I could read it and not add anything new to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time you look at it, every time you read it, you see something.
Oh, I gotta go ahead there. I gotta go ahead there.
Pretty soon, chapters aren't 24 pages anymore, but 240 pages.
Exactly. Will fit.
Yeah. For he will come.
Question, and this is just something I was thinking. You are adding these additions to Yada Yada, aren't you?
No, I know it's going to be a new book. A new book.
Just a total, just observations, just the whole new book. Okay.
Observations for our time, a new book. There are three chapters currently completed, and I'm working on the fourth now, and they are going to get posted. I think they're available probably in a number of sites now. I think Richard has them up. I think there's some others.
You're not going to get carried away or anything, right?
In the sense of writing a whole other...
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Just stop right there. That's it.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah, I can't tell you. Can I tell you where it's going? No. I mean, all I know is that the first chapter is Proverbs 6. We're reviewing it now. The second is 1 Samuel 7:3, which and then insights related passages to the religious things that God is trying to divert us away from, and then the third chapter is on God's treatise on why we ought not trust government, what government will seek to do to those that it controls, and the fourth chapter is on Psalm 91. I think that the likelihood from there is that I'll do at least two chapters on other Shaul sightings that have been shared, and go back into Hosha, go back into Yashaya, and to cover that. I do think that since a theme is to stay away from the whore of Babylon, from religion and politics, I'll translate Isaiah, Yashaya 17 as the Satan is associated with Babylon. I think that would be an interesting thing to do. So that gets you out about 8 or 9, 10 chapters into it. And then from there, we'll kind of see where it goes as to whether or not we'll continue to do Proverbs and Psalms, or we'll, in terms of just the relationship that Yahweh envisions and what we should avoid, his fatherly advice, or do we go to the thing that I think most people find the most fascinating, which is end times prophecy. But
can I ask one quick question before
you
get further? You know, in 6:16, which we hadn't gotten to yet, they used the word 7, and rather than just write 7, I kept looking. It says it means to be 7.
Yeah.
When you say something, is that 7 dimensions?
Yeah, I think so.
I do, too.
Yeah, I do.
I passed that line several times, and I said, oh, okay. Well, you never paid much attention to it, but it's in light of with all the discussions with Roy and so forth, and this the one you just were doing with Larry, I think it's absolutely good, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the nature of Jacob's ladder as well, is that while we're not told the number of rungs on it, we're told so many times that the answer is always 7. That
is
right. that is the number, and we can be intuitive, and we can figure it out. So here we go. I want to, you know, the previous statements in Proverbs 6 says that, what's it going to take for you to wake up? What do I have to do to get your attention? Because being apathetic here, being lethargic, being unaware is a really dangerous place for you to be. Because
and
unaware,
what number are we on? I'm sorry.
We're going to begin on Proverbs 6:11, and I'm just talking about 9. Whereas God's saying there's a real consequence for being ignorant here, because if you're unaware, you're going to be ill-equipped, and there's going to be a guy that's going to come, and if you're unaware of my perspective, of my Torah directions, he's going to beguile you, and you're going to lose everything. So here is God saying, introducing us to Paul, and it begins, "For he will come walking and behaving like a leader or guide, taking control, and you will lack what is needed, and have a scarcity of something absolutely vital, needing what you do not have, causing you to be bereaved and diminished." So somebody is coming, according to God, and this was written he, so it's singular. One individual is coming that is that God is concerned that his people are going to be misled because they're ill-prepared. They lack something that is vital. The only thing I'm aware of that is vital is the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing if you're not willing to study his Torah, come to know it.
You got nothing.
Then this person that's going to behave like a leader, going to claim to be in charge, going to claim to be a guide, going to take control. You know, Paul said the entire Gentile world was his, that he was the leader. He was the guide. He was the apostle. And if you're ill-prepared, he'll eat you up alive. Now, you would
say... And it's obvious that he was the guy, because that's... Because Yahweh chose Yahochanan to write the letters to all the ecclesia. I mean, it's pretty obvious it was Paul.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So, we now have a hint here that this lone individual that he's talking about is Paul. But it gets more direct. He then says, and this is 6:12, "A confusing and incorrect, a wicked and worthless man, a mystifying man, a vile, evil, and troublesome man, a man that is abhorred, detested, and valueless, ungodly and unprofitable, destructive and corrupt, and inconsistent and non-conforming." This is from Baal, "baffling and confusing, difficult to understand as the result of commingling, and Bali, to be lacking and without, to be negated and for naught." So a man that commingles and is confusing and incorrect, and man is Adam, singular. This is one person. And unjust, dishonest, evil and vain individual, ish. A person, singular. Travels about with speeches which are wrong, false, crooked, perverting and corrupting, with words which indicate he's a pervert. This is 6:12. Now, there is no question here that God is talking about a single individual. He can't make it any more clear. A man, one man, singular. A singular individual is coming with speeches that are false, crooked, perverting, and corrupting, with words that indicate he's a pervert. And he's going to travel around and be known for these words. Do you know that of all the people that claimed to be a leader, who claimed to speak for God, who twisted and perverted what God had to say. There's only one that was known for his travels, and he is known more for his travels than he is for anything else. Well, his travels and his words. Paul. And we went through today on all the places that Paul went. Hopefully that's in the second hour, and we have half an hour, we didn't lose it. But it takes you 20 minutes just to go through his travel log. And so here's this man going about to all these places, marking the Gentile world, if you will, as his territory. And the whole time, he's corrupting and perverting what Yahweh said. That's the lone man who did this. Now, if you don't think it's Paul, come up with somebody else.
I feel like we're back in Scotland.
Muhammad really only traveled between two places, Mecca and Medina. Joseph Smith pretty much stuck to Utah.
Right. And you look at he stayed in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And you look at Hadrian, while he traveled a fair amount, his travels were principally between Rome, the battles in Jerusalem and Yehuda, and then he had to go to Greece to perform the Dionysus rituals. But
yeah, the only other one that would come to mind would be Siddhartha, but he didn't talk in the name of God, so that was him.
Nobody else is twisting the Torah, destroying the Torah,
yeah.
Not twisting. And a lot of them twist. Akiva twisted, but he didn't certainly write his own new Torah.
Now, then it says this individual is going to come with a sinister winking of his eyes. He subtly signals the vacillating nature of his proclamations by shuffling about regarding circumcision with his stance, while casting aspersions with his fingers. The sinister winking, and as we talked today of the eyes, is indicative of Paul claiming that, I'm going to be whatever I need to be to gain an advantage. I'll be Jewish if that works. I'll be a Gentile.
I observe the Torah.
Sure. I'm a rabbinical student, and nobody knows that stuff better than I do. That's me.
And he gives all his defenders tap dancing room. Look over here where he defended the Torah. Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
he doesn't want
to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't want to. And by the way, all you prove when you defend the Torah once and tear it down 100 times is that you can't be trusted. If you say the Torah cannot save and you say that the Torah is cruel and that it's of the flesh and it enslaves, and then you say the Torah is wonderful, I support the Torah. All you're displaying there is you are filled with personal contradictions and you can't be trusted. And the reason that a person does this, like there are many statements from Muhammad that if you're taken out of context, you say, all right, that's, there should be no compulsion in religion. And then he has 100 lines that said, if you see a Jew, kill him. If you see a Christian, it's not going to be accepted of him. He's your enemy. And if you side with him, we're going to kill you. And if you reject Islam, we're going to kill you. But there's no compulsion in religion. So they throw out the one line so that people seeking to defend them have a line to hang their hat on. And that's the same thing with Paul. But all you do is you prove that you're a liar. That's all Paul does by his one line that says he supports the Torah is proves that he can't be trusted. That he's not even consistent with his own message.
Right. Well, it's the same thing Muhammad did, right? If I get my word and then I find something that's better, I go to that.
Internal inconsistency is the quickest sign that someone's lying and you can't trust them.
Correct.
Good point. Right. That's right. That's right.
This subtly vacillating regarding his proclamations by shuffling about regarding circumcision is from Malal. And Malal's primary meaning is to circumcise. It speaks of circumcision. And so the stance that God is saying is sinister, and the vacillating proclamations that that God is trying to alert us to are regarding circumcision. Now, there's only one person in all of human history that drew a line in the sand that based his corruptions on circumcision. Paul, that's it. And his position was even vacillating. As we shared today, the fact is, as Paul was called into Jerusalem, because the disciples had heard that he was speaking against, that he was speaking out against circumcision, and he was torn up for it. On the way out of town, what does he do?
He circumcises his
partner.
Right, he circumcises Timothy. Talk about a hypocrite. You know, he says, if you're circumcised, you can't be saved. And on the way out of town, he circumcises Timothy?
Yeah, that's another thing they use, by the way. That's another thing they use, the defenders of Paulos, where his words have been so corrupted. Whoa.
So they say that because he circumcised Timothy,
that
he wasn't against
circumcision, then we should dismiss him anyways. You know, either
well,
way, you're dismissing
Paul. My argument to that is since the oldest thing that of Paul's writings is P46, and you can look at it, and he talks about how people in the Torah should be that observe the Torah should be castrated, especially those getting circumcised. He wished them castrated. And then how he calls it pornos. If that's the oldest writing you have, wow, what corrupt...
Yeah, P46 is a late 3rd century document.
Mm-hmm.
It's the closest, and it's comprehensive. It's got all of Paul's letters in it. Closest manuscript, extant material, to the original autograph of anything. And so if Paul's testimony was corrupted and changed from what he wrote within 20 years of when he wrote it, then and what you've got is garbage, then you have to toss it out anyway, just as James said.
Yeah. It's against common form.
But
the fact
the oldest
is,
that you have, what they try
were
to
not
do.
Corrupted. You know why we know that they weren't corrupted? It's because he says the same thing. His letters say the same thing. He's
right.
Against the Torah. He's against the existing covenant, and he's against the disciples. And he claims God's authority for the entire Gentile world. And
which was his first letter? Which one was
Galatians.
His first? Was it Ephesians?
Galatians.
Oh, Galatians.
Galatians. Right. Galatians was first, and then he wrote the four letters between Corinth and Thessalonica, and then his sixth letter was Romans. And you know, between those six letters, he has confirmed and reconfirmed everything that he had to say, all of which is untrue. He didn't write anything that was true. So here
he didn't even get his name right.
No.
He lied about his own name.
Correct. Didn't even come in his own name. And this is the interesting thing, that he is, all while casting aspersions, while hurling destructive accusations, which overturn valid teaching. Yara is the basis of Torah. Yahweh tells us when he introduces the word Torah for the first time, he tells us that Torah is based on Yara. Yara means to teach. And so he is casting aspersions, Yara, while hurling destructive accusations which overturn valid teaching. Again, we're right back at Paul. Then he writes, with confusing and false perceptions which invert reality in his heart from his perspective, guiding his thoughts and conduct, his motivations and goals. He devises and inscribes antagonistic schemes without consideration or consequence, which are evil and adversarial, raw, in everything, continuously creating controversies and contentious strife, stirring up heated, bitter, and violent conflicts through human knowledge and academic philosophy, as one who claims to be sent out as a messenger to do away with something important. You know, God is doing his best to awaken the comatose. Remember, he began this by saying, what is it going to take for you to wake up and to stop being so unaware? And here he's laying out his case against Pauline Christianity. Obviously, it wasn't enough.
No one in the world does this. No. He's brought this up. And it's laying there. It's just been laying there.
It's laying there. Yeah. You know, confusing and false perceptions which invert reality. Every time that Paul quotes the from the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, he takes the point that John was making and he inverts it. And he does that by taking a statement out of context, truncating, shortening the sentence, so he only includes some of the words that were in the sentence, and then mistranslates it from Hebrew to Greek, so that he can give the impression that God is saying the opposite of what he is saying. You know, it's like the first King James translation of the Ten Statements, and it says, "Thou shalt commit adultery." Well, it does say that.
Adultery.
They forgot the law, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." But
no,
you know,
they forgot it. I thought they could flip that by people and get it in there.
"Thou shalt commit adultery." Now, what is interesting here is, of course, that Paul's whole argument against the Torah was he was antagonistic towards everything that God stood for. I mean, essentially said that God's testimony couldn't be relied on, that God was impotent, he couldn't save anybody, and that his Torah was obsolete. And God is saying this individual is going to be adversarial. Well, Paul in 2 Corinthians admits that he's demon-possessed. He says the thorn in his side is a messenger from Satan for the express purpose of keeping his ego in check. Now, can you imagine nearly 2 billion people today believing, aligning themselves, acknowledging that they're part of a religion that was created by a man who admitted that he was demon-possessed? And they carry it around.
Yeah, I can imagine it because it's happening. I mean, it's totally bizarre. I mean, there can be no question that it's completely out there. You know, but
I mean, how many times have you told people in notes that that Paul admitted in the last chapter of 2 Corinthians that he was demon possessed?
300.
And is there anybody who has said, "Wow, you know, that changes everything"? I never
defenders of Paul.
But,
no.
Yeah.
No. 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 They. You know, see, the thing about these the people that tap dance for Paul, I call them Paulettes. What it is that they do is instead, and they tap dance, you know, I mean, they're tap dancers, unbelievable tap dancers. What they do, no matter what you throw up, I mean, you can show direct assaults on the Torah. Okay, God said this, Paul said
Romans,
this, God
Romans
said
7,
this.
The most inverted, insane, irrational diatribe ever uttered in the name of God. Romans 7. Romans 7 is the woman's husband died, and she's now freed of the Torah of the husband. And in the same way, we're now freed of the Torah of God.
This is lovely,
There's no Torah of the husband. You can't equate the Torah to a dead man. And there's no correlation. None of it. This is there's no correlation between these things. You know,
but can show them, as an example, you can show them, "Call no man father," you know.
Right.
Now, this is Yahusha talking. He won't even call himself father. The father's greater than I am. You know?
Right.
And then, "Call me father and be followers of me. I'm your father." And you know.
Right.
And you show these side by side. I mean, just things like that. Or you show them where Hosea, they've they've put kings and governors in positions that I didn't know. And he's saying, my God. And you show that right in a row. And they start dancing around words and become basically insane parrots for their religion is all it really comes down to. So, no, if they're a Paulette, no matter what you show them, look at Chabawook. If a person's rational, I mean, you just went through this here, in this particular Masal, but, it's the same thing. There's only one man that fits, right? I mean, there's nobody else that fits.
And God is actually going to tell us that the reason he's opposed to religion in this very proverb is because it renders its victims irrational. There's no way to reach him anymore.
I showed a guy, call no man father, don't be, and then Paul goes out and says, be followers of me, and all this. And he goes, well, there's several different types of fathers that can be spoken of here. So he's doing exactly what Yahweh told him not to do, and you've got an answer for that. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So with confusing false perceptions which invert reality in his heart, he devises and inscribes. And by the way, Paul both devised his scheme and inscribed it. Antagonistic schemes without consideration of their consequence, which are evil and adversarial. In other words, he's associated with the whore of Babylon, with Satan, in everything, continuously creating controversies and contentious strife. As one who claims to be sent out as a messenger to do away with something important. Shalak. I don't think that Rabbi Akiba ever claimed to be an apostle. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure Muhammad didn't claim to be an apostle.
No. He claimed to be a prophet. But
yeah, in fact, I don't even know. Muhammad never claimed to be a prophet.
Well, not Akiba, but Muhammad.
No, Muhammad never claimed to be a prophet. Never once. In fact, in the Quran, which is really Muhammad's voice, the Quran says that Muhammad's not a prophet. He said he was never given the ability to be a prophet, that he was not a prophet. The Quran specifically acknowledges that Muhammad is not a prophet. Now, Muhammad in the Hadith attempted about a dozen prophecies. They were all ludicrous, but the gist of them is the world was going to come to an end and the day of judgment would be 500 years after his death.
Yeah, 1100 CE, if I recall.
Correct. Uh-huh. Didn't happen.
And when that happened, that women were going to outnumber men 100-1. That's there,
right.
too.
Right. They're all going to be hoary-head.
I believe you said wishful thinking.
Yeah. And that's right. And all the rocks and stones are going to cry out, there's a Jew behind me, kill him. At that time. Muhammad was not a prophet, never claimed to be a prophet, never got a single prophecy right, which is the same thing with Paul. Paul never claimed to be a prophet. He did provide one prophecy, and he got it wrong. Once again, Paul's the messenger. And, you can say, okay, well, Muhammad did claim to be a messenger of Allah, But he didn't do away. He didn't try to do away with the Torah. Muhammad falsely claimed that his Quran confirmed the Torah. Now it's the antithesis of it, but he claimed that it confirmed the Torah. Paul specifically was doing away with the Torah. Now the reason all this is important, and the reason we're hammering Paul here, is because God thinks it's important. God thinks it's important, so important that 3,000 years ago, he revealed this warning against Christianity. Upon this, therefore, suddenly, surprisingly, openly, albeit briefly, he will arrive with his destructive opposition and ruinous calamity. He will smash, shatter, breach and break something vital. And as a result, he will suffer affliction in an instant. And there will not be any remedy. There will not be any cure. There are not a lot of things where Yahweh says, I can't save them. I can't fix it. I can't resolve the problem. There is no remedy and there is no cure. Even for his people's wayward nature, the Israelites, he said, you know, I got a cure for that. I can resolve that. For the religion of Christianity, for Pauline Christianity, God's saying, I've got no remedy. I've got no cure. That means there can't be a single Christian in heaven. Not a single Christian ever has been saved. And Paul, his destiny is to be condemned. There is no remedy, there is no cure for the affliction that he has perpetrated. He is going to suffer affliction. You know, the Hebrew word typically, this happens to be the word shabar, but the word that actually means to respond and answer, but in the one place where it's dealing with Yom Kippurim and it's rendered in most Bibles, afflict your soul as opposed to soul shall answer and respond to the invitation, approaching the maternal light of Yahweh. The reason that the words distant meaning beyond this is anah, from answer and respond to affliction, is if you don't answer and respond to Yahweh's invitation, your soul will be afflicted. You know, it's also there so that we know that Yahusha's soul was afflicted, so our souls would not be. Well, here's God is saying that the consequence to Paul that he brought on himself is that he's going to be afflicted. And that the thing that he smashed and shattered, and there's two things that he tore asunder, the Torah and his covenant. Two most important things in the universe. And you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody else that shattered something that was important to God.
Kind of interesting. Here's a little tiny little side. This struck me on that one, on the shattered part. In the olden days, they used broken shards to write on, and then you connect that with all his writings that do these, they break it. I mean, it's an odd little thing, but it's just fascinating to me how he uses little words that have multiple.
So at the time, because paper was invented in 400 CE, and so Paul would come onto the scene and start writing in about 52 CE and finish in around 70-something CE. That
he didn't have papyrus. Yeah.
No, so he could have written on papyrus. He couldn't have written on paper. He could have written on papyrus, and he could have also written on parchment. It's likely he wrote on papyrus, but he would say that the writing implement would have been a broken shard.
Mm-hmm. And well, that's one of the meanings of shabar, you know. And
yeah, no, I meant paper when I said papyrus.
No, he could not have written on paper. Paper would not be invented until the 4th century.
And so they would have probably been using a shard.
Yeah.
Very likely could have been.
Yeah. Possibly. It's just they talk about as broken pieces of shard, you know, and he's writing, but he also used them as writing implements. So I'm trying to get more Yada-like. Connect all these little dots. And just because they're just amazing. It's a strange language that you can do all this. You couldn't write something like this in a million years on any.
No.
Oh, here's one for you.
It's interesting too that you mentioned affliction, because Paul was big on that. Like he thought he was suffering from Messiah. And
that is
a noble thing.
Yeah,
to be afflicted by man was a noble thing.
Yeah.
He, in fact, he talked about all of his suffering and how his suffering was completing the inadequacy of the Messiah's suffering, and he has one place where he goes on for about what must be 100 words that he ties together in this sentence, and it talks about all the times that he was beaten and drowned and pulverized and whipped and all that sort of thing, all the affliction that he suffered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right.
It was a legacy of his Pharisaical upbringing. too.
Yeah, but you know, the I don't see where where we have any other Pharisee that's out there in the self-flagellation. I mean, it's there were Christians that did it. I mean, I think a lot of what is considered today part of the great tribulation of Christians under Diocletian is actually self-flagellation. They sacrifice their own lives to demonstrate the validity of their faith. So they kill themselves. And in fact, there's a lot of lines from the Romans at that time saying, you know, if you're so insistent on getting killed, why don't you just walk off a cliff? I mean, why are you bothering us? Why are you hounding us to kill you? But just don't bother us. Just go kill yourself if that's what you want to do.
And is God ever
today, if you look at Roman Catholicism in the Middle America, South American region, Mexico, South America area, they will crawl on glass to show their faith and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. Back in the ancient days, they used to walk on hot coals to demonstrate their faith. And you know, you look at the times in medieval Europe, where whole countries would have days where they would go, where everybody would go whip themselves. They would beat themselves to a pulp.
Martin Luther climbed up the steps with bloody knees, constantly winning.
So they do take on that secondary. They do take on that meaning.
And imagine a God that would say, you know, what I really want you to do is I want you to suffer pain. Right, if you suffer needless pain, that's going to please me.
So
pretty sadistic God.
Oh, it's the God of religion.
That's the kind of God who would
weird.
Say, "Love me or burn in hell."
Yeah, it's the same kind of
and
God that would say that I'm going to create a being to get down on his knees and worship me. I'm going to create a being to tell me 24/7 how wonderful I am, because that'll really make me feel good.
Oh yeah, that's. There is a third thing that Paul attacks. One thing that jumps out at me now is he totally misrepresented the Spirit. There's a lot in his writings about the Spirit and how that it was in a completely different understanding than the Torah and Yah.
Yeah, his spirit is first was masculine because he was representing the spirit of Hasatan. Yeah, it's always masculine. While the Greek word for spirit is a neuter term, Paul, when he applies a pronoun, applies a masculine pronoun. But Pauline, the spirit in Pauline Christianity is a Gnostic entity. You know, in Gnosticism, there was the dualism where the physical world was imperfect, and the ideal world was that spirit world that was non-physical, and there was no way for a physical entity to be perfect. And so, for Paul, anything of the flesh was corrupt because of Gnosticism. He used Gnosticism to sell Christianity.
He was having a field day with the Gentiles. He was having a field day with the Gentiles.
Right.
And,
Gnosticism blend with Dionysus.
The Messianic circles who want to defend Paul. And, you have Shimon Kefesh saying that he's hard to understand. Then why would you put them in with a group of people that don't have any background knowledge in the Torah?
He not only said he was hard to understand. What he said was he used circular reasoning and he was a sophist. And if somebody calls you a sophist, that means you're using philosophy. Come on.
In the Messianic circles, though, they would say that, it's not that Paul was contrary to the Torah, it's just that we don't understand. He's such a high level, he has such a high understanding of the Torah that it's easy to misunderstand. That's how they interpret what Shimon Kevesh said. But at the same if that's true, then why would he be responsible for the Gentiles?
That's not what he said.
No,
you know, I put the note up. I don't know if you're in the chat room or not, but I put the note up on exactly what he said, word for word.
Yeah.
I mean, there it is.
I just got that.
No, what Jason's doing is he's representing the Messianic group and how they'll defend.
No, I understand. He's not doing it yet.
Right. Yeah. And
just,
of course,
it's an impossible situation.
Right. You know? And what, of course, is interesting here is the excuse is to ignore what he actually said. There are things that Paul wrote that are clearly gibberish, that they don't make any sense in any language. They're just poorly written. And there's a lot of what Paul said that's just flat out poorly written. And to say that something that is poorly written is at a high level is to be ignorant. But
most
of what Paul said
is
clear. It's just clearly wrong.
I want to give you guys something here. I mean, seriously. Okay, and this is just going to be, this is just a quick quiz, very, very quick. Mm-hmm. I committed a sin in humbling myself because I preached the gospel of God to you without charge. I robbed other churches taking wages to serve you. Who said that?
Paul.
Okay, good. Now, who said this? Without money or cost. Listen carefully to me, incline your ear, and come to me. Listen that you may live. So I will be able to establish an everlasting covenant relationship with you. Who said that?
Yahweh.
Yeah, without money or cost, he opens up. See, this is the kind of thing where I'm saying, and this is what I'm talking about here, where I've actually got these in notes side by side.
Yeah.
We're the only assembly.
We lost Jason.
I got
a note that he was
too bad.
He dropped out.
And I realized Jason was talking about the Messianics. It wasn't Jason. I knew that.
I've realized that evidence and reason means nothing to a religious person. So a religious person is going to excuse Paul with feelings, not with evidence and reason, because it can't be done. Evidence and reason condemns Paul. And the only way that I'm going to approach any of this material is, what does it say, and what does that mean? And what Paul said, and what he means, is wholly and completely contradictory to what Yahweh says and means. And he wholly and totally contradicted the Torah. And this notion that, he was talking about the oral law, you can't make that argument. He never once...
That's ridiculous. As I was saying before I got cut off there, is that, like, we're the only really assembly, if I can use that word, that really we have this understanding. Like, I don't know anybody else who has this, and yet it's such an important prophecy. And we're the only people that really understand it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'm shocked still to this day that what we have found is so obvious. And there's none of us that are bragging that, we are really smart because look what we have found. What we found was always right there. It's clear, it's obvious, it's in our face. And yet, why are there so few people that are willing to accept the God's own testimony in His own words?
Then it has to be true that they don't care. They don't like Him.
We're the only ones that could actually do something about it. You know what I mean? Like through your books, Yada, and your commentary. I mean. Where you're the only person really pointing these things out, you know?
Well, I think I was the only person there for a while, and now there's a bunch of us doing it. But we're all doing it together.
Yeah.
And
personally, I've had somewhat of a difficult time last couple of years just being in business and stuff. But I've gotten out of that now, so I'm going to have, like, I'm going to be working for somebody else, like Continental 12s. I'm going to have 14 days off a month. And I really want to just, I don't know, I really just want to get these points together and just get it out there, you know. So,
you know,
so liberating to get rid of Paul. I remember when I first heard you talking about it back in the days with Yoel, and you first started to come, like, to realize what Paul was really saying. I was right there at that time when that was going on, when you were first coming to realize that.
You know, when I really did that originally, I lost my closest friend at the time over it, and it seemed so shrill, and it seemed, you know, why aren't you just talking about the things of Yahweh? Why are you spending all this time exposing and condemning Paul? And here we are. I thought this proverb was just going to be fatherly advice. I started it because William, the elevator man, our dear friend, sent me this passage and asked me, you know, who do you think this woman is that's being talked about in this passage? And it's before a Babylon. And I didn't know it was going to be about Paul. And the very fact that Yahweh, even 3,000 years ago, spent this much time, this many words, exposing and condemning Paul, tells me that there are very few things that we could do with our time that are more important during this time,
yeah, this time,
than to expose and condemn Paul using Yahweh's testimony. So,
well, he put them all out in many different occasions. This just being
all
one
of
them.
Yes.
The amount of damage he's done, and
more
we're the only people
history.
that can know and do anything about it.
You know, God, you might think, would have a lot to say about Islam, and he does. And he's really antagonistic towards Islam. There must be, you know, 1,000 mentions of the religion of Islam. But God knows as well as we know that the Quran is so stupid and Muhammad was so disgusting that you don't need God's warning not to be a Muslim. And Muhammad was so despicable and his Quran is so insultingly stupid that if you're going to believe it, then there's nothing that God can do to reason with you. I mean, God's way too smart to appeal to you if you're going to fall for something that stupid. But when it comes to Pauline Christianity, it's a different story. Paul wasn't stupid. Paul was evil.
He was
but
clever,
Paul was
too.
Twisted. Yeah. But and Paul was clever. His ploys were clever.
Less, what
God is saying here is true.
Yeah.
Is if you are not informed regarding the Torah, he'll fool you.
Right. You know, over in Dabarim, when Yahweh says, surely a person who proclaims a message on behalf of a deity who oversteps uh-huh. their bounds to speak words right. in my name, which right. I haven't instructed or directed him to speak, and who speaks in the name of foreign Elohim, indeed that prophet shall want to die, telling us there is that third
yeah.
place.
Yeah.
And you ask any Christian today how they're saved. They're saved by what? Grace
yeah.
and faith.
Right. Faith in the gospel of grace.
Yes, God's spell of gratia. Whoa.
Yes.
God's
yeah,
spell
not,
of gratia.
Yeah.
God, that was straight from Paulos,
yeah.
wasn't it?
Jason is correct. And while I will tell you, I personally enjoy the nurturing, uplifting testimony of Yahweh. Yahweh has a job that needs to be done. And right now, there's 2 billion people trapped in the religion of Christianity. And there is no one else out there that is an authoritative spokesperson quoting Yahweh's testimony to expose and condemn the religion of Christianity based upon its author, Paul, other than us, our little covenant family.
Yeah.
And it's what God wants done. It's what he did for us, just no one's paying any attention to it. So, Jason,
like
I think
I said,
I,
like,
You know, I would much rather, personally, I would much rather spend the time just enjoying the uplifting statements of Yahweh. But, you know, we've got an eternity to do that.
Yeah, that's comforting to know.
You know, Eliyah went out way out of his way to expose
right.
Baal and his lies. I mean,
he did. Did you when you read Yashaya, when you read Yirmiyah, when you read Eliyah, do you find guys speaking for Yahweh that saying, "Oh, you are all so wonderful. Everything is just going to be peaches and cream." Or do you find
people in opposition to the world?
Isn't the whole thing of Hosea
a
God's animosity towards the religious nature of his people?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah. I just went back to the ITG audio archives, and when you went through the name chapter, and there's nothing even close.
Someone asked about Aaron in the chat room what it meant earlier. I believe it means free will.
Enlightened free will.
Enlightened
free will. Yeah. What a marvelous name. You know, Moshe is a name that means to draw out, and Aaron means enlightened free will. God's really smart. But God's own testimony doesn't mean anything to those people caught in religion. That's why this diatribe against Pauline Christianity began by God asking a question. So what's it going to take? What do I have to do? What do I have to say? What has to happen for you to wake up?
You know what? One thing I thought of doing is once I get my ducks in a row as far as arguments go, I think it'd be kind of interesting just to, you know, call into Christian radio stations and harass them for a while with really good questions.
Yeah. You know, the beginning of Questioning Paul now, where it goes through, I don't know if it's 10 or 20 questions. You know, I said, you know, that Christianity claims, but that cannot possibly be true. To go through those with a Christian radio station, they claim that God died for their sins, but that can't possibly be true. God can't die. You know, they claim that God has a church, but you know, you go through each of these things, and then, you know, there is no word even remotely akin to church. And
I would like to
recognize the ecclesia as a translation of mikra. Oh my goodness! Now we're right back in the Torah. Or you say, you know, they'll claim they have a New Testament, and you say, wait a minute, the only reference to a renewal of the covenant speaks of a time that has not yet happened. And when it does happen, it's going to be based entirely on the wholesale incorporation of the Torah.
It's still relevant.
It's been negating any New Testament. And
renewal. So
yeah, and just 2 weeks ago, we were talking about where Yahweh says, do not think there is absolutely no chance whatsoever that I'm ever going to split my covenant into two.
Yeah, that was pretty clear. That was kind of a death knell.
Mm-hmm.
If you could get one question on in one of those broadcasts,
right.
How many people would just, because for me too, I remember still when I was in a Bible study before they asked me to leave. I remember reading in Acts, and I was like, wait a minute, Paul circumcised Timothy? What is that though, really?
Yeah.
Don't you think that was an embarrassment at that point? He was actually confronted with people that knew right from wrong? I mean, that's all it was.
No, you know, I think that the whole
thing, when they live,
that Paul recognized that the arguments that were brought against him at the Jerusalem Council were right. He was already too dug in. But if you look at what God says about circumcision, if you're not circumcised as a male, you cannot participate in Passover. If you can't participate in Passover, there is no eternal life. And then he says, if you're not circumcised as a man, you can't enter heaven. And I'm sure they quoted both of those passages to Shaul. And if I know them, they knew them.
who knows? I mean, they may have just rejected him outright and been hostile to him.
But then why would he circumcise Timothy?
I mean, the fact that he turned circumcised Timothy, I think he had to be convicted by the argument.
Agree.
But there's another possibility here.
Yahweh said that his position on circumcision would be shifty. If he didn't circumcise Timothy, then his position on circumcision was no longer shifting. It would have been wholesale opposition, but the fact that he circumcised his lover tells us that his position on circumcision was hardly anything set.
Whatever is expedient, he said.
Whatever is expedient. Yeah, whatever.
Whatever keeps people listening to me. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. So then,
should have stoned him 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, I wish. Now here's the things that God says are an abomination and hated. So it says, "Behold, these six things Yahweh hates, and seven are an abomination to his soul." So there's six things on this list that God hates, and there are seven that are an abomination. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm pretty sure I know which one of these is just an abomination. But God hating something is worse than an abomination. So there's of the six things that God hates, all of them are an abomination. But there's one thing here that is strictly an abomination, but not specifically hated.
Okay.
And it begins, haughty eyes and visions of grandeur, observations, including a rebellious perspective. Something God hates is a self-exalting public display, a defiant view, a proud outward appearance. You know, if you're going to work with Yahweh, you ought not claim credit. You know, it's like when you were saying that where else do you find this kind of material, and the answer is no place else. You don't find us jumping and saying, yeah, aren't we great? No. What we say is, isn't Yahweh great?
Absolutely.
It's all there. All we did was read it and present it. You know, and if the moment you think that, you've got visions of grandeur, you're done. God hates that. And then it says, a deceptive tongue. Why? Because false and misleading statement, that's the very essence of how people are betrayed and deceived. And number three on the list is hands that shed innocent blood.
There goes militarism right out the window.
Yeah, it's that whole idea of militaries, not something God's fond of.
Like bomb the hell out of them.
Right.
Things like
a
that.
Heart which yeah. devises and writes troublesome, idolatrous, unjust, and false plans. And the heart here is, of course, the seat of reason in an individual. So it's their perspective. It speaks of their motivations. But someone who's motivated to write down that which is unjust, false, and evil. You know, so far we're...
I just don't know what an abomination is then, because my understanding of abomination, I mean, that's an abomination.
All seven of these are an abomination. All seven. There are six
but they're
of
beyond
seven,
that he doesn't hate
that
the misleading.
That God hates. So there's six of the seven that God hates. There are seven that are, all seven are an abomination.
Yeah.
This is the one
so
that
he
God doesn't
hate.
This
okay.
next one. This next one God doesn't hate. Now, for God to
All
hate,
right.
he's got to know what you're doing. All right?
Mm-hmm.
For God to hate something, he's got to know of it. He's got to have an emotional response to it. He has to be extraordinarily adverse to it. It's beyond
yeah,
an abomination
it's something
now.
Invested in it.
He's got something invested. And this next one, he has nothing invested in. This next one is feet, which rashly and impetuously run to and fro, darting about to approach that which is evil. Now, if you're scurrying after evil, there's people, you know, they run to whatever the trendy religion is or the trendy adaptation of the religion, whether it's...
They run to church on Easter.
Yeah.
They run to church on Easter.
Right. And their Scientology is chic in Hollywood. They run to that. And in Utah, of course, it's Mormonism and you know, various places in the world, there's the, you know, the new chic religion. But people throughout time have flocked to religion. God doesn't hate them. It's an abomination what they're doing. It's disgusting. It's repulsive what they're doing, but God doesn't hate them. Doesn't even know them. So the feet didn't run
through
religion.
Well, I think that comes down to, that's his plumb line. It's like, if you're not interested in the truth, then, like, really, you're not breaking my heart by, you know, being destroyed.
Correct. Yes. So the feet that run darting about, approaching that which is evil, those are the victims of religion. God doesn't know them. They don't know God. There is no emotional attachment here. God couldn't know them. If he knew them, it would tear them apart. And so that's the reason why sects are hated. And it still means that being religious is an abomination. But it doesn't garner God's ire. The one thing you don't want to do is get God mad. He's not the person you want mad at you. And if you are scheming and designing the troublesome, unjust plans, writing them, which is what Paul did, that gets God mad. If you're killing innocent people, that gets God mad. If you're proclaiming that you're an apostle and you're not, and that you're speaking for God and you're not, and that you were given the world's population and you were not, that gets God mad.
Interesting, though, maybe he was an apostle, but an apostle reeks of Nicolaitan type of philosophy.
Yeah.
So,
right, it does.
You know,
the hierarchical.
So, yeah. So, okay,
exactly.
Yeah, you're an apostle. So, get out.
So, the next two are both hated and abominations. A maligning soul whose breath utters sedition, breathing out slanderous and deceptive testimony, which incites the deluded to worship false gods. Well, there's not a lot of people that, other than Paul. I mean, certainly Muhammad did that as well. And then, one who claims to be sent out as a messenger to do away with something important, creating controversy and contentious strife between brothers.
That would be Paulus.
Yeah, that would be Paulus. Yeah, you've got no other candidate there, because the Arabs and the Jews are not brothers. And Muhammad never did away with the Torah. He claimed that his Quran confirmed the Torah. And so the only person that really claimed to be sent out as a messenger to do away with something important and create a strife between brothers is Paul.
Oh, yeah, well, right at the first, right at the very beginning, there he was in front of Shimon and the other disciples in strife.
Yeah.
That's what he brought from day one.
So the supposed leaders, for whatever reason, they were considered supposed leaders. They meant nothing to him. He's talking
the supposed
about
leaders, the elders.
He's talking about the disciple. Yeah, it's just the way he's talking about the disciples specifically: Yohanan and Jacob and Shimon Kefer, Peter, James, and Paul, are Peter, James, and John. And he's saying, you know, these supposed leaders, for whatever reason that they, you know, you all think that they're important. I mean, nothing to me. What a
deal. But they never elevated themselves, and they didn't make a lot of noise, and they didn't have to argue that they were sent from God and all this kind of stuff. They were just in the position where, yeah, we spent a lot of time with the Son of God, so, like, you know, You know,
one of the things about
they were in a position to like to give insight into the Torah.
I'm not even into the whole Son of God thing. I'm into the Son of Man thing, which is a diminished part of Yahweh. I mean,
yeah, I am too.
I don't know why that it is.
Why he used the term that he constantly referred. I think the Son reference is valid when you understand that Ben is from Bana to build the family name, and that Ben would be an individual who comes in the Father's name doing the Father's business.
And I
don't have a problem with Son and family from that point of view. It's just that, and I think, Jason, you know this really well, is that Yosha himself referred to himself as the Son of Man because he was a diminished manifestation of Yahweh.
More than anything else.
And he never wanted attention brought to himself. He most certainly didn't want anybody praying to him or worshiping him. And he just says, I'm trying to point the way to the Father.
But he obviously had understanding. That's what I mean. People that are interested in the truth will grab.
Yeah, he authors the Torah. That's pretty good when it comes to understanding.
That's what I meant by that. You know, people that are interested in the truth will gravitate towards people that possess
right.
it. You know, that have a deeper understanding. So.
And people who
I wanted to point
will
this
call
out
those who gravitate to the truth and who proclaim the truth liars. That's what an insecure person
does. I was in front of a banker today who told me that his favorite place to be was wherever missionary work needed to be done. And I proceeded to tell him about Yahweh's words. And you know what he said about that? Yada, yada, yada. What he said, I looked at him, I thought, what an ass.
You know what he's doing? He's completing the sacrifices of Christ. That's
of course.
What he's doing.
Yeah. It's that one of the things that we learned in the review of Shamuel, when he was speaking of Shaul, is that Shaul was good, but Shaul was wrong.
Wrong.
And what we found is that being good, and that people are missionaries because they wanted to do good. They want to be considered good people. They want to do a good thing. It's like JB wrote me a note, and I included it into a rewrite I just did of one of the chapters where I think it was the third chapter of Observations, where God says, you know, you can't buy influence with me. I'm not going to be influenced with anything that you do or provide. And what God is saying is that good doesn't matter. Good doesn't cut it.
He doesn't say walk to
Shaul. King Shaul was good, but he's not in heaven.
But, you know, I got a response to that banker there for you, Larry. Yada, yada, yada. Yeah, I am all about yada, yada, yada.
Yeah,
I want to know.
I wrote it down for him. I said, you ought to go look at Yada Yahweh. You know, that's
it. Yeah, start by knowing.
I'm all about yada.
It didn't matter with this guy. Yeah, it didn't.
By the way,
what
James wrote me the other day, and I included in this chapter, is that heaven is not a reward. It most certainly isn't a reward for being good, but it's not a reward for anything. You know, heaven is a family home. Being in the family isn't a reward. It's a relationship, but it most certainly isn't a reward. There are aspects of things you can do in a family that can be rewarding, but being part of the covenant is not a reward. There's nothing, you know, when you think of reward, it's something that you get for being good at something. And
no.
It isn't based upon being good at anything, and it isn't a reward. You know, we're not bragging that we're in the covenant because, you know, we've done something good to earn it. No.
Yeah.
We're right with Yahweh.
You want to know how insane this idiot got? I'll tell you how insane he got, because I pointed out that basically he said, oh, man, there's something I said. I don't pay homage to Amun-Ra. Yeah, you may not know this, but there were placeholders, and they finally added one. And by the way, Aman, a word that was used in Paleo-Hebrew,
right.
was never used at the end of a declarative statement as some kind of a religious reference to something. And he said, well, you know, that when I painted the picture of the cross,
he would say Amen at the end of his letters.
Well, here's what the clown said to me. Well, God... I don't know who Yahweh is. I would say Yahweh, he says, but I don't know who that is. But God, the same God, because we have the same God, he says, the same God created good and evil, so it wouldn't matter. In other words, you're out there worshiping Satan on Sunday, and it wouldn't matter. It
because
really
God
wouldn't matter
good.
To this guy.
And by the way,
yeah.
God did create good and evil. He did create good and evil. Absolutely.
Sure.
And you have to ask yourself, so why did he create good and evil?
Would that
and
be
by the
choice?
Way, you know,
the purpose is
why would
choice?
Why would a God be worth worshiping that was to be worshipped?
I got an answer for that, Yada. He created good and evil to separate. You can't separate without having the two.
Of course. Well, I know why he created good and evil. We all know that. What's the purpose of free will? What's the purpose of choice? How do you have love?
That's why the seventh isn't he doesn't hate, because
right.
the existence of evil, it that's the plumb line. Is
right.
If you're deceived, you know it's sad, but you've allowed.
I don't know. I don't. Yeah, God doesn't know you. He doesn't hate you. If you're deceiving, he hates you. If you're killing his creation, if you are leading people away from him, if you are being deceptive, if you're claiming to be what you're not, you know, that's then you are the victimizer. God hates the victimizer. As we all should. It's the moral thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I began this the rewrite of the first chapter by saying, hate is a virtue.
Yeah.
God
and evil too. It's
the,
interesting
the
that we still consider this. We consider both good and evil now. That the knowledge of good and evil was in the midst of the garden, and
yeah.
even to this day we're considering it. You know,
well that's the that
we,
that's why it was
we,
in the
we have a knowledge of,
the
of both.
It was the center of the garden, so therefore choice is paramount. I mean, there's no way in the world. I mean, can you imagine? Yahweh's pretty smart, and can you imagine having two naive people who have always been taken care of trying to deal with a being that's about, you know, exponentially smarter than they are and 14.7 billion years old and crafty? Who do you think Yahweh thought might win that debate? You know, I mean, really. It was to provide choice because they had to choose to come back to Yahweh, and that's what made the relationship real. Thus, choice. Thus, you know, good and evil.
Yeah.
Simple matter. Right?
All right, my friend. Yep. We've reached the bewitching hour here in terms of our time. So we are still recording, but have done the broadcasting. It's a good place for us to pick up next time we can. And I appreciate you joining us, Jason. That was great. Your first point and every point thereafter. Your first point on when it talks about being afflicted. There's only one guy who claimed to speak for God that constantly bellyached about being afflicted, and that was Paul.
Sure.
And
that was
a
good.
We are on a mission. This is, you know, the mission that God wants. Done is he wants people to know what he had to say about government and about religion and particularly about Islam and Christianity, because it's half of the world's population, maybe more than half, and it's just a shame that so many people have been fooled by something as ridiculous. And if it wasn't for the fact that religion renders its victims incapable of thinking, the obvious failures, the contradictions, the inconsistencies in these religions would immediately cause believers to reject them. But, religion is a very powerful opiate.
Yep.
All right, guys. Well, I enjoyed our chat. Yeah, look forward to being with you next Shabbat. And we'll keep on writing, and hopefully we'll have a lot more on the 91st Psalm, and we'll maybe even have a home for the first four chapters of Observations for Our Time between now and then.
That'll be nice.
Yeah. Good night. Hey, and Kirk, I'm not getting too excited. I can hear the excitement from here, man. Okay.
I'm holding back for you.
You're staring me over here.
It's like a riot.
I'm listening to every word.
Sure, I'll do that.
All right. You got it, Kirk.
Night, guys.
Bye-bye.